Thank you very much for coming, Mr. President, at a huge moment of supporting the Ukraine.
The war in Ukraine on this one-year anniversary. Thousands dead, millions misplaced. We look at America's resolve to safeguard democracy as President Biden makes a surprise visit to Kyiv. We detail the Vatican's repeated calls for peace, and a look at potential war crimes as thousands of Ukrainian children disappear into Russian re-education camps. A murder claims the life of a beloved priest in Los Angeles. His Catholic community is shattered from parishioner to archbishop.
Just being an oblate, I love being an oblate. I love being an oblate, Sister Providence. I love what I do.
Life within Black religious orders. We go in depth as we commemorate Black History Month. And an interview you will only see here. The man who scored the winning points in this year's Super Bowl talks to us exclusively about the importance of his faith and sports. EWTN News In Depth starts now.
Democracy stands. The American stands with you, and the world stands with you. Kyiv has captured a part of my heart.
As we mark the first anniversary of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, the President of the United States makes a historic visit to a war zone to show American resolve to help Ukraine and defend democracy. It was a dramatic statement, marking the one-year anniversary of the beginning of the war between Russia and Ukraine. For the first time in history, an American president traveled to a war zone not under the control of American military forces. Without their protection, it took months to work out the clandestine maneuvers necessary to get Joe Biden safely by train to the Ukrainian capital of Kyiv to meet with President Volodymyr Zelensky. Even then, air raid sirens rang out as the two leaders stepped outside in central Kyiv to visit a war memorial to fallen soldiers, a signal to the populace that Russian jet fighters had taken off from their home bases and were in the air. The pair had just visited St. Michael's Cathedral, where President Biden was greeted by Ukrainian church leaders, including the primate of the Orthodox Church of Ukraine, who thanked Biden for America's support. Biden's trip came at a crucial moment in the war as fighting is expected to intensify with spring offensives. Having the American president beside him provided important symbolism for Zelensky, who expressed his gratitude.
I really appreciate that President Biden, American society, being from the very beginning of this tragedy, from the very beginning of this full-scale war, from the first days being together with us. First phone call of support was from White House to Ukraine. And thank you for your leadership. Thanks bipartisan support. Thanks Congress.
In appreciation, President Zelensky walked with Mr. Biden to Kyiv's so-called Alley of Valor to show him a plaque installed there in his honor for providing American support in the largest war on European soil since 1945. President Biden left Ukraine on a 10-hour train ride back to Poland, where he met with Polish President Duda in Warsaw. Poland has provided key support in the war, accepting large numbers of Ukrainian refugees, providing military training grounds for Ukrainian troops learning to operate advanced equipment, and being the gateway for military shipments to the front lines. After meeting with President Duda, Mr. Biden delivered a major address on the war from the gardens of Warsaw's Royal Castle.
President Putin's craven lust for land and power will fail, and the Ukrainian people's love for their country will prevail. Democracies of the world will stand guard over freedom today, tomorrow, and forever. Brutality will never grind down the will of the free, and Ukraine will never be a victory for Russia. Never.
The president wrapped up his trip by joining a meeting of the Bucharest Nine in Warsaw. The group of nations makes up the eastern flank of the NATO alliance. They came together in response to Russia's 2014 annexation of Crimea. These leaders worry Vladimir Putin's next move could be military action against any of the nine if Russia is successful in Ukraine. The president assured them that Washington is aware of the threat and that the U.S. and NATO stand behind them. This week's meetings reflect the concern over the devastation of war, which has taken a huge toll on both the Ukrainians and Russians. Hundreds of thousands of people, military personnel and civilians, have been killed, millions of people displaced, and the balance of power disrupted throughout Europe and the world.
Bombs over Kyiv, tanks on Ukrainian soil. What started as a cold, quiet winter night on February 24th in 2022 turned into the day Russia invaded a sovereign European nation. President Vladimir Putin called it a special military operation. He ordered so-called peacekeeping forces into two breakaway eastern Ukrainian regions. That special military operation has turned into a war, lasting now for a full year. Last February, the Western world assumed Kyiv would fall within days of the invasion. But after weeks of battle, inexperienced and poorly trained Russian forces using outdated equipment proved ill-prepared to face Ukraine's resistance. Much of Ukraine's success came from military training it had already received from Western allies. And then, in the months to follow, billions of dollars worth of weapons, supplies, and financial support. Ukrainians' resolve and determination to defend their homeland has also proved a major factor in their defense. President Volodymyr Zelensky reflected the high morale of his people when he famously refused to evacuate, saying, "I need ammunition, not a ride."
"We are not putting down arms. We will be defending our country because our weapon is truth. And our truth is that this is our land, our country, our children, and we will defend all of this."
On the ground, Russian morale seemed to pale in comparison. Thousands of men fled Russia to escape its first military draft since World War II. Burned out or abandoned Russian tanks littered the roads in Ukraine.
"These people came to help us, but for some reason they are running away from us. They got what they deserved because of what they did to people here."
Both countries grapple with a staggering death count. U.S. officials estimate likely hundreds of thousands killed on either side. The United Nations says the civilian toll could be as high as 8,000. The brutality of the war and the Russian focus on killing civilians was quickly apparent. Within months of the war, almost 500 Ukrainians were brutally killed in Bucha, more than a dozen of them children, many hastily buried in mass graves. And the war has spurred a mass migration. More than 8 million Ukrainians have left their homes to seek safety and shelter in the West and neighboring countries like Poland, adjusting to life, but desperate to go home.
"You know, we've already adapted, but we miss our native land very much, as we say. We miss our sofa, lying on it, putting on our favorite dressing gown, and just being at home. Most of all, I miss my family, my husband, and my son. For us to be together."
Ukrainians who remained in their country have faced a brutal winter, many often without power or food. As the war enters its second year, many analysts believe it will be difficult for Russia to achieve any of its military objectives. But without continued support from the West, Ukraine could face a bitter year.
"In order for us to win soon, we need fighter jets, rockets, so that Ukrainian servicemen will not be killed, as it's happening now."
From the very first days of the war, Pope Francis has been far from silent. His pleas for peace began immediately. Here's EWTN News Vatican Bureau Chief Andreas Tannhauser.
"Forgive us for war, O Lord. From the very beginning of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, Pope Francis has condemned the war, praying for it to end.
Lord Jesus, born in the shadows of bombs falling on Kyiv, have mercy on us."
But the Church has not stopped at prayer and spiritual support. On both the diplomatic and humanitarian level, the Holy See has launched its own offensive to ease the plight of the Ukrainian people and bring a stop to the violence. The day after the invasion, in an unprecedented breach of diplomatic protocol, Pope Francis went to the Russian embassy to the Holy See to plead for peace. Many other initiatives for peace have followed. The Secretariat of State has used its representations around the globe to advocate for a peaceful solution to the conflict.
Especially in our days when we are seeing a lot of conflicts everywhere, starting from the war in Ukraine, which is a very, very object of great concern for everybody. I think that diplomacy is a way just to help to promote and enhance peace in our day.
Cardinal Pietro Parolin partnered also with Italian President Sergio Mattarella to launch a new version of the Helsinki Accord from 1975. At the height of the Cold War, most European countries committed again to the inviolability of borders and peaceful resolution of conflicts. The church has also provided humanitarian aid.
Did you feel a sense of hope?
Many organizations, such as the Knights of Columbus, Caritas, or the Pontifical Mission Societies, immediately launched appeals to help refugees and those affected by bombardments in the country. While Pope Francis has repeatedly voiced his wish to go to Ukraine, he has had to send the papal almoner instead. Cardinal Konrad Krajewski is in charge of delivering aid in the name of Pope Francis. He has traveled to the war-torn region several times to bring help directly from the Holy See. EWTN Vatican correspondent Colm Flynn has traveled twice to the country to document the plight of those who have remained.
Despite the fact it was very hard to continue working, living, studying, and so on, I decided that the best decision for me was to continue the life.
For us, the time of war.
EWTN Ukraine has not stopped to broadcast from Kiev, where Father Alexander and his team made sure to bring the news to all the Catholics in the country.
Maybe there is some tension in the heart, some fear in the heart of people, but in the same way we try to trust that God will help us, especially also during these days.
We are trying to understand why it's happened for almost 1 year on this terrible phase of war.
Peace seems still far away, as the Ukrainian ambassador to the Holy See points out.
War, even in 2 days before the war, I said, no, it's impossible. From any rational point, it's something incredibly unrealistic, but it's happened. And in this way, I am always trying to respond for the challenge of possibly installing the peace. I believe that in some way, we cannot say right now exactly, but in some way, it will come soon. I really hope, and a lot of people are praying for that.
Several times recently, Pope Francis again urged an end to the horrors of war. But even after a year of fear and violence, the prayer for peace is yet to be answered. In Rome, Andreas Tonhauser, EWTN, News in Depth.
Among those most vulnerable during this time of war, the children. Thousands of Ukrainian children have been orphaned or separated from their parents. A disturbing new report finds that separation has often been orchestrated by the Kremlin. Children sent to so-called re-education facilities in Russia under the guise of summer camps. Most still wait to return home.
Putin seeks to rob Ukraine of its future by taking its children. Russia's system of forced relocation, re-education, and adoption of Ukraine's children is a key element of the Kremlin's systematic efforts to deny and suppress Ukraine's identity, its history, and its culture.
A possible war crime with all levels of Russia's government involved. Ukrainian children, from infants to teenagers, held in Russia's custody during the war. A new report from the Yale School of Public Health and the U.S. State Department sheds light on Russia's effort to abduct and indoctrinate children from Ukraine. At these camps, many Ukrainian children are taught a pro-Russia education and even given military training. Russia collected consent from parents, but often under duress or false pretenses, and contact is now strictly limited. Many are held far past their expected return date, and many parents have been told they would only get their children back if they came and picked them up. But the distance of the camps can make an already dangerous and expensive journey almost impossible. The numbers are striking, with at least 6,000 children reportedly sent to Russian camps. The report states that Russia operates 43 of these facilities, and likely more are engaged in these activities. Four of these camps, and possibly more, have suspended allowing children to return home to Ukraine. Russia's network of children's facilities stretches from one end of the country to the other, some of them hundreds of miles from Ukraine's border. For perspective, the farthest camp in eastern Russia, almost 4,000 miles from Ukraine, is three times closer to the United States than it is to the Ukrainian border. At the center of these efforts is Maria Lvova-Belova, Russia's Commissioner for Children's Rights, who has also spearheaded the forced adoption of hundreds of Ukrainian children into Russian families. Through bright and cheerful social media posts, Lvova-Belova and other Russian officials paint the deportations as humanitarian efforts for Ukrainian children. But the effects could be devastating on children and families already dealing with the horrors of war.
Such actions obviously will have serious long-term implications on these children's development. The devastating impacts of Russia's failing war of aggression will be felt for generations to come.
Nathaniel Raymond led the research that produced this alarming report. He's the executive director of the Humanitarian Research Lab at the Yale School of Public Health. Nathaniel, thank you so much for joining us. Tell us about this study and how it was conducted. There have been rumors of these camps. They've been floating around for months. But tell us exactly why this was so critical.
This report was the first effort to comprehensively document allegations that Russia is forcibly relocating, re-educating, and in some cases, adopting Ukrainian children. While there have been allegations for months, as you said, this was the first report to take the totality of open source information, primarily from Russian officials' own statements, combined with social media from parents searching for their children, and then fusing that together with high-resolution satellite imagery to locate 43 facilities, 41 of which are alleged summer camps, and to identify approximately 6,000 children that have been in Russian custody.
Wow, that's a lot of children. What is the relationship like between the Yale project and the State Department?
We are an independent research institution. We are part of the Conflict Observatory of the U.S. Department's Bureau of Conflict and Stabilization Operations. So we were able to work with the State Department to have access to critical data sources to do this report, such as satellite imagery.
That's probably very helpful in being able to identify both the camps and the children. You were talking about the adoption of these children. Most of these children were not simply abducted. How did the government get them under their charge? And why did parents, if they did agree to this?
That's a really important point. And I think that all the parents watching the show can understand the position that parents in particularly Donetsk and Luhansk in Ukraine's east were in. They were offered often by teachers or by trusted members of village councils the chance to send their kids to a quote-unquote summer camp, what's now referred to as a vacation trap. And in many cases, they signed over power of attorney to Russia in consent forms where the Russian officials' side of the form was left blank. They were trying to get their kids out of the fighting. And then months have gone by. And in the case of 10% of the facilities we've identified, the scheduled returns either have been suspended or outright canceled in some cases.
And in leading these so-called humanitarian efforts, Maria Lvova-Belova has a big role. She's been identified as the leader of this initiative, and it's said that there are U.S. sanctions against her. Can you tell us more about her role and what you've discovered?
Maria Lvova-Belova is the Kremlin's point person for both the re-education and the forced adoption of these children. She is public enemy number one. as it relates to the abduction and relocation of these children. Maria Lvova-Belova, in a press event with Vladimir Putin 48 hours after a report came out, said that she herself had adopted a child, a 15-year-old boy, from the Donbas, and that the military training element of this program would be expanded by 2,000 Russian and Ukrainian children.
So then when you talk about the role that she's playing, what else can the U.S. do to target her if she is public enemy number one? U.S. sanctions have been floated.
Sanctions were levied this morning by the U.S. government against four regional governors who are critical to this program. And this is an important point, that this is a whole-of-government effort by Russia that includes particularly local governors and mayors.
So it is a local effort. Russia was alleged to have taken children when it took Crimea in 2014. From your work, is that true? Is this similar in action and motive?
This builds on a system that was operational since 2014 and has expanded it to make it the largest single act of child abduction we've seen since the Holocaust.
And have we seen war crimes that target children like this in the past aside from the Holocaust, or is this singular here and expanded?
Well, that's a great question. Notably, during the dirty wars, aka the civil wars, in Central America, such as El Salvador and Guatemala, children were taken and put in the U.S. adoption system in the 1980s. I've actually been involved in efforts in the past to help DNA identify those missing children. So this has happened before. But the scale and intentionality here is unprecedented since World War II, and it constitutes an alleged war crime and crime against humanity.
Nathaniel, what can be done then to solve this crisis and bring Ukrainian children back home?
Step one is registration. Underneath the Geneva Convention, Russia, who is a state party to the treaty, is required to register the children under international law. Step two is communication. These kids need to be able to phone home and call mom and dad right now. Step three is monitoring. We need to get the Red Cross and UN agencies on the ground to verify where these kids are and the conditions in which they're being held. And step four is they need to be out of Russia immediately to a neutral third-party country, which is required by law.
Nathaniel, one last question for you. You're an academic. You're studying this crisis. Was there anything that was particularly personally shocking for you?
Well, so much. But 48 hours ago, I don't know if you've seen the footage, but children from Mariupol, including one 12-year-old girl, were brought to a stadium in Russia and forced to read a script in front of a crowd with Putin present and soldiers who had sacked Mariupol, in many cases destroying the communities these children were from. The girl broke down in tears and said she couldn't read the script. For me, that is the human face of what we've documented in this report. These are children who are being held as hostages. They are being used as props and potentially being used as poker chips in a very dangerous game where they could be used in bargaining for prisoner returns or peace negotiations with Ukraine itself. People often ask me, what's the worst thing that could happen in the war in Ukraine? Is it a nuclear strike? Is it chemical or biological warfare? And I say the worst thing has already happened. They took the kids.
Well, that's illuminating. Thank you so much, and thank you for the work that you're doing.
Thank you for having me on.
There's much more ahead on EWTN News In Depth. The Catholic community responds after a beloved priest is murdered in his Los Angeles home. We take an in-depth look at Black religious orders as we celebrate Black History Month. And faith and football, our exclusive interview with the Super Bowl hero who is celebrating in prayer at a Catholic monastery.
I'm Colm Flynn, and I'm here in St. Michael's Abbey in California. And later we're going to be finding out, after winning his second Super Bowl in 4 years and taking the winning kick, what drives Harrison Butker.
We'll see you there.
Don't walk in the street, walk on the sidewalk. You're not supposed to have a veil on. You're not supposed to be a religious. So it was a lot of prejudices that Mother Lang had to overcome, and she did it beautifully.
A religious sister of the Oblate Sisters of Providence recounts the early history of her order, founded by Mother Mary Lang in 1829. The women religious have educated generations of children ever since. Welcome back to EWTN News In Depth. In February, the United States celebrates Black History Month, honoring the people and heritage that did so much to help build America. That heritage is also evident in the Catholic Church. The percentage of Black American Catholics remains under 10%. But despite small numbers, reporter Mark Irons tells us the impact of Black religious orders is strong.
I thank God for my life every day.
A common theme among these religious sisters in Baltimore is joy.
I just can't tell you how marvelous it is. You'd have to live the life.
They're Catholic nuns, happy to live out their calling from God.
To care for souls, many people might not like to.
Some are old enough to remember when an obstacle to their calling was skin color.
I lived right across the street from a group of nuns who were white nuns, and it was unacceptable at that time for me to join them. So I joined the Oblates.
In 1958, Sister Brenda Cherry found a welcoming home with the Oblate Sisters of Providence, the first successful Roman Catholic religious order established by women of African descent. Going back to 1863, in the heat of the Civil War, President Abraham Lincoln declared freedom for many enslaved African Americans with his historic Emancipation Proclamation. But before that, the founder of the Oblate Sisters of Providence, Mother Mary Lang, broke a racial barrier way ahead of her time. And she's now on the path to possible sainthood.
Her mission began right here in Baltimore with the founding of this school. More than 30 years before President Abraham Lincoln signed the Emancipation Proclamation, Mother Mary Lang established St. Francis Academy because she believed African American children had the right to an education.
And a year later, in 1829, her first group of Oblate Sisters of Providence came together, making vows, embracing a life of service to God and the vulnerable in society, while rejecting racism and accepting those deemed unworthy at the time.
The first U.S. Catholic sisterhood to reject that racist and sexist notion that a woman born into slavery lacked the virtue necessary to enter religious life.
Dr. Shannon D. Williams has learned a lot about the stories of Black Catholic nuns in the U.S. A history professor from the University of Dayton, she includes many of those stories in her own book, Subversive Habits.
The story of how generations of African-American Catholic women and girls fought against discrimination and exclusion to answer God's call on their lives.
Williams is Catholic, and she grew up with the faith, but it wouldn't be until adulthood and further research that she would learn more as a child.
And we were unaware of the existence of Black nuns in our church.
Williams says the number of Black nuns has historically been around just 1% of the total U.S. population of Catholic religious sisters, and those same numbers apply to Black priests.
So as a little child, I said, priesthood is for white.
Even as a child growing up in Nigeria, Father Xavier Edit was initially unaware that he could become a priest one day. He went to a parish where the priests were white, missionaries from Ireland.
If I am white, I would love to be a priest. Because as a little child, you know, I was thinking that priesthood is for the white. So I said, I wish I was a white person. I would have loved to be a priest.
He eventually would see African men ordained to the priesthood and would later go on to pursue his calling. Father Adate is now the pastor of St. Francis Xavier in Baltimore, one of the oldest church communities in the U.S. where Black Catholics could come together and worship.
And it's a loving community. We welcome everybody.
As a priest, Father Adate's a member of the Josephites. His religious community was founded in 1871, not long after the end of the Civil War, to serve African Americans at a time when many weren't accepted into Catholic churches. Or if they were, they were segregated, assigned to back pews, or treated as second-class citizens, a trend that would continue in many places for nearly 100 years. As Sister Brenda Cherry shared in her own account, racial discrimination was a reality within Catholic religious communities in the 1950s. Anti-Black acceptance policies of the past meant men and women were denied the ability to become nuns and priests, and the church feels the loss today.
It hurt the church as a whole, because where would we be now if we had had all of those vocations? But it certainly is a painful reminder of someone who is still a practicing Catholic, right, that for some people, you know, race came before faith, when our Catholic tradition teaches us that faith comes before everything else.
In researching for her book, Williams interviewed many Black nuns. She says it was hard to hear tough stories of discrimination, but inspiring to learn of a tenacious faith to follow God's call.
They had to accept us because we weren't going to take any less. Always, God steps in. Providence, that's where we get oblates. This is a providence. Providence will provide. And he did provide.
Sister Mary Pauline was inspired to join the oblates when she learned about the determination of founder Mother Mary Lang.
A woman who is so determined, and I'm the type, I don't give up on things like that.
Maybe today, Father, into the Son, into the Holy Spirit.
Sister Pauline says she's faced some forms of discrimination herself, people questioning her ability to lead because of her accent. Following the gospel, she left her comfort zone, home and family in Ghana, more than 5,000 miles away, to join the nuns in Baltimore. But she often visits the same person Mother Lang did, Jesus, under the form of Eucharistic bread. One of the founder's quotes is, "Hasten to the Blessed Sacrament." Sister Mary Pauline follows that advice, and that is where she finds her strength.
It is because of the tabernacle, the Blessed Sacrament. I put all my challenges. Today I'm smiling here, but you don't know, sometimes I go there and I cry.
Serving African-American Catholics today, Father Xavier Adeet hopes his witness may inspire young people. The reality is, Black Catholics are a minority in the U.S. Church, and like he did as a child, they may need a witness of what being called to a religious life can look like.
Have that connection to say, oh, if he can do it, I can do it. Or to look at it and say, oh, he looks like me, he resembles me. It's not about us anymore. It's about what legacy are we going to leave for the younger ones.
Mark Irons, EWTN News in Depth.
Welcoming all children to receive a good education was a big part of Mother Mary Lang's mission. The church has yet to canonize a Black man or woman from the U.S. But Mother Lang, a servant of God, is one of six Black Americans currently under consideration for sainthood. Top news headlines are next in the Week in Review.
I'm brokenhearted. I've been crying for the last 2 days knowing that he's no longer here to share all of his inspiration.
A Catholic community mourns after the shooting death of a beloved priest known for being a peacemaker.
I mean, his service after his presidency is extraordinary. No question about it. He won a Nobel Prize for it.
And a grateful public reflects on the legacy of Jimmy Carter as he enters hospice care. And later, yes, there can be a link between your fitness and your faith. We'll be right back.
Every day he worked to show compassion to the poor, to the homeless, to the immigrant, and to all those living on society's margins. He was a good priest and a good bishop, and we are very sad to lose him.
Los Angeles Archbishop Jose Gomez brought to tears while speaking about the loss of his auxiliary bishop, David O'Connell. The deadly shooting of the beloved bishop in the Archdiocese of Los Angeles tops the Week in Review. O'Connell worked in South L.A. for years, focusing on gang intervention, brokering peace between residents and law enforcement after the Rodney King riots, and spearheading work with immigrant children and families. O'Connell was found shot dead in his home in Hacienda Heights last weekend. Prosecutors charged the husband of O'Connell's housekeeper, Carlos Medina, who had also done work at O'Connell's home, with killing the 69-year-old auxiliary bishop. Detectives say Medina's SUV is seen on surveillance video at O'Connell's home at the time of the shooting. The community is shocked and saddened at the news of his death.
This was a brutal act of violence against a person who's dedicated a life to making our neighborhood safer, healthier, and always serving with love and compassion.
He's just a beautiful human being. It's just hard to believe anybody would even consider hurting him in any way.
Community members have held several vigils and prayer services in the days following the bishop's death. A motive for the murder is still unclear, though there have been reports Medina thought he was owed money. If convicted, Medina faces up to 35 years in prison. Another deadly earthquake rocked the Syria-Turkey border on Monday, killing at least six and injuring hundreds of others. It came just 2 weeks after a massive 7.8 quake killed more than 44,000 people in both Turkey and Syria. The new earthquake, a 6.4, was quickly followed by a strong aftershock, causing buildings already weakened to collapse in both countries. More than 1 million people have been left homeless, many now living in tent cities. The crew of a Norfolk Southern train tried to slow down just before the train derailed. That's according to a preliminary report released Thursday by the National Transportation Safety Board. Investigators say crew members became aware of an overheated axle moments before the derailment. The accident 3 weeks ago prompted evacuations when toxic chemicals in danger of exploding were released and burned. Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg toured the area on Thursday and says the railroad industry and Congress need to initiate changes for safer rails.
Having these factual findings is an important step toward being able to move on to the phase of policymaking.
The Environmental Protection Agency will lead the disaster cleanup. The EPA has ordered Norfolk Southern to pay for the cleanup or face tough penalties of up to $70,000 a day. One conservative and one progressive candidate advanced in the nonpartisan Wisconsin primary for a state Supreme Court seat. The high-stakes election could impact major policy issues like abortion and voting rights in the battleground state. Some say it's the most important statewide election in the country until 2024. The race included four candidates, two progressives backed by Democrat interest groups and two conservatives backed by Republicans. Liberal Janet Protasiewicz and conservative Daniel Kelly advanced to the general election. Protasiewicz topped the field with 46% of the vote. Conservatives currently hold the majority in the Wisconsin Supreme Court, 4-3. If Kelly loses in the April general election, the court will flip to progressives for the first time in decades and could break a deadlock between the Democratic governor and Republican-controlled legislature. The governors of 20 states are joining forces to strengthen and expand abortion access in the wake of the U.S. Supreme Court overturning of Roe v. Wade. Led by Californian Governor Gavin Newsom, the so-called Reproductive Freedom Alliance states are highlighted on this map, including several presidential battleground states like Michigan, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. It allows the governors and their staffs to share best practices to affirm abortion rights, including language on executive orders to protect abortion, ways to protect abortion providers, strategies to maximize federal financing for birth control, and support for manufacturers of abortion medications. Jeannie Mancini, the president of the March for Life, issued a statement saying the governor's alliance does not reflect what public opinion polling shows. Citing a recent Marist and Knights of Columbus poll, she notes 7 out of 10 Americans would limit abortion to at most the first 3 months of pregnancy. Mancini says a majority of Americans support pregnancy centers that help women facing unexpected pregnancies. Former President Jimmy Carter is receiving hospice care at his home in Georgia following a series of hospital stays. The 98-year-old is the oldest living U.S. president in history who has survived several health scares, metastatic brain cancer, and brain surgery. Dozens of well-wishers are making a pilgrimage to the Carter Center in Atlanta.
I just brought my sons down here today to pay respect to President Carter and to teach them a little bit about how great of a humanitarian he was, especially in the later ages of his life.
The Carter Center said in a statement that the president wants to spend his remaining time at home with his family. A public display of our faith. Catholics around the world celebrated Ash Wednesday this week. While Ash Wednesday is not a holy day of obligation, it typically attracts a larger number of people to church than other celebrations, not including Christmas and Easter. Catholics in Washington, D.C. lined up at the Basilica of the National Shrine of the Immaculate Conception for their ashes.
Lent, then, is the time to remind ourselves who is the Creator and who is the creature.
In Rome, Pope Francis ushered in the Lenten season, urging Catholics to avoid the pretense of being self-sufficient and instead turn to God for their needs. Due to ongoing mobility issues, the Holy Father did not participate in the traditional procession from the Church of St. Anselm to St. Sabina before Mass. Uniting Americans to pray for our nation in a special 9-month novena. The Dominican Friars launched a Rosary Novena on January 30th and are asking you to take part. On their website, rosarypilgrimage.org, you can sign up to receive electronic prayer cards via email. The novena will culminate with a day-long Dominican rosary pilgrimage at the Basilica in Washington on September 30th. You can join the novena at any time, and if you cannot attend the pilgrimage physically, you can join it spiritually. We've heard of walking closer to Christ. How about jogging closer to Jesus? Up next, a unique program that interlaces exercise and our Catholic faith. The Lenten season has begun. Did you give up a favorite food or decide to add something new to your prayer life? The sacrifices we make during Lent can have both spiritual and health benefits. Eating healthier, increased prayer, and exercise are all ways to honor the body God gave you and draw closer to Christ. We look further into that as we begin this penitential season. Lindsay Fullerman, a coach and founder of Fit From Faith, joins us now to explain how your faith can inspire fitness and a healthier lifestyle. Lindsay, so great to have you here. What inspired you to start this ministry, and how did you ground it in faith?
Hi, thanks for having me. So Fit From Faith really stemmed from really my own experience and my own wounds. I grew up just as an athlete, and I developed two eating disorders when I was in middle school. So I was anorexic and a binge eater, and that was something that I didn't really share with people. I really kept that private, and, you know, all throughout high school and college. And it wasn't until after college where I started to ask those deeper questions of, you know, how can I become healthy? How can I become balanced? And I turned to the church for help, just to get help for, you know, these struggles that I was really experiencing. And I went to see a priest, and I asked this priest, you know, what is the Catholic health and wellness resource that can teach me how to be healthy and balanced for life? And he said that there wasn't one. And so when I left his office, I was somewhat bitter, you know, that the church didn't have a resource. But I also felt that the Lord really was calling me to create something for the church, to really be a gift and a resource to people on how to get healthy and balanced for life. And that's what really began my own healing journey. And that's what really became the real birth of Fit From Faith is really how everything started.
Now, people say that this resource is something that you've created for the laity, but you also have coaching moments with priests and religious. Tell us about what that looks like and why it's so important.
Sure. Yeah, I definitely. Fit From Faith actually originated at the seminary in Cleveland. So I was taking classes there in the master's program. And that's where the human formation director, who is a friend of mine, he said, hey, can you help our seminarians to become healthy so that they can become the best priest that they can be? So that's where I really started, was coaching seminarians and eventually priests. And with Fit From Faith, it's, you know, they receive a lesson. And then with that lesson, with suggestions for habit formation, you know, with nutrition and exercise, they apply that lesson to their life. And then there's a coaching aspect involved. So they sign up for one-on-one coaching and group coaching. And it's really within the coaching where the magic really happens and the Lord's grace really goes to work to help unpack that lesson and sort of the challenges and joys that they may be experiencing within formation or within their ministry as priests.
Now, Lindsay, you just bravely shared with us some of the challenges that you faced as a young woman in trying to figure out your relationship with food, with fitness, and with your body. Do you see in your coaching that priests struggle in the same way?
Yes, I think foundational pieces that I've seen across the board with lady men and women, seminarians, priests, religious men and women, we all tend to have struggles with our, you know, taking care of our bodies and the way that we see ourselves. Because at the end of the day, before we are, you know, a priest or a religious or a wife or a mom, we are human. And that is the one foundational element that we all have in common, is that we are human. And so it's a very natural part of our human nature to struggle with the body, to struggle with how we care for it, because it's really a part of original sin. So it's a part of our fallen nature as humans.
Well, in our humanity, we have a tendency to want to fix things really quickly. And many people use Lent as an excuse to get back in the saddle. And during a recent interview with actor Mark Wahlberg about Lent, the secular television media actually labeled Lent a 40-day challenge. How do you recommend people approach fitness regimes during Lent?
It's a great question. Yeah, I think we have a tendency to sort of want to white knuckle our way through Lent. Like, oh, I'm going to give up coffee, or I'm going to give up chocolate, or I'm going to commit to exercising every day. And I'm a big fan of the principle of gradualism. And so it's taking perhaps these 6 weeks of Lent and starting with what I can do this first week. So maybe this first week I can, you know, exercise for 30 minutes twice a week. So it's starting there for week one of Lent. And then once that starts to become a habit, you know, perhaps in week two, we introduce maybe another day of exercise, and then we work to really make that a habit. Or you can do the same approach with food. You know, maybe it's, I'm going to eat a healthy breakfast during Lent, you know, just to help my energy levels. So I'm going to start there for this first week of Lent, and then I'm going to add to that discipline. Perhaps that meal at breakfast, now that you're eating it, maybe it becomes more healthy, perhaps more whole. And so I'm a big fan of this principle of gradualism, which really encourages, I think, really sort of restoring ourselves to wholeness instead of trying to white knuckle our way through the process.
That's right, a step-by-step approach. Well, Lindsay, we're so grateful that you felt this call and you answered it. And we look forward to learning more about this and to applying some of these principles in our Lenten journey. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
You can visit fitfromfaith.com to learn more about its services and sign up for a program that works for you. Up next, our exclusive interview with the player who scored the final points to win this year's Super Bowl.
When it went over, that moment, what went through your mind?
There's still 8 seconds on the clock, or whatever it was, but I made it. Well, going into the kick, I knew there's still some time on the clock. But I made it, and it's just a blessing to be in this position and to be able to have helped my team succeed.
If you're a football fan, you already know about Harrison Butker, the Kansas City Chiefs kicker, who scored those last exciting points to win Super Bowl 57. But what you may not know about him is the guiding light that defines his life and his success on the field, his strong Catholic faith. It's no wonder that for his first exclusive on-camera interview since the big game, he agreed to sit down with the Global Catholic Network, EWTN. Harrison shared his faith journey with our Colin Flynn.
This is the nail-biting moment the Kansas City Chiefs won the Super Bowl. And the player who took the winning kick, 27-year-old Harrison Butker. Harrison is the team's star kicker, and this is the second time in just 4 years he's helped make the Chiefs Super Bowl champions. And after the Super Bowl win, I traveled to California for an exclusive one-on-one interview with Harrison. Why in California? Well, for a reason you'd never expect. We'll explain in a moment. But first, we started by chatting about how he's feeling after such a high point in his life.
The biggest high, you know, a lot of people would think, oh, the game-winning kick, which definitely was an amazing moment. That's something that you dream about as a kicker, to have the game-winning kick in the Super Bowl. But the parade we had a couple days after that was unreal. And you could see how many Kansas City fans just live and breathe football, and how you succeeding on the field can bring so much joy to so many people.
What's it like, that moment, Super Bowl championship, you're standing there, you're about to take the kick that is going to decide the game. Like, what's that pressure like? What's that feeling like in your head?
A lot of pressure. You know, I'm not going to lie and act like I'm a robot and say I was not nervous at all. Obviously, I was nervous, but one thing that's helped me throughout my career is taking a deep breath, praying is something I always do on the sideline to remember that, yes, football is so important, but it's not the most important thing. I need to calm down. Number one, it's good to realize I'm a child of God. You know, think about my life outside of this world. Think about my beautiful wife, my children, and then think about the talent that God has given me. And I have this opportunity on this massive stage to glorify Him.
When it went over that moment, what went through your mind?
There's still 8 seconds on the clock, or whatever it was.
8 seconds later, and Harrison was a two-time Super Bowl champion. In post-game interviews, some of the players said how they were going to celebrate, but when it came to Harrison, he surprised many people by thanking God.
You know, I wouldn't have been able to get through the season if it wasn't for my faith in God and to be able to trust in Him and know that He's got a plan. And, you know, I'm just thankful that, you know, His plan was for that ball to go through and for us to win the game.
Away from the screaming fans and all the celebrations, Harrison has traveled to this quiet corner of Orange County in California, to St. Michael's Abbey, where seminarians and monks live a life of prayer. Harrison is joining them for a week-long retreat.
When someone wins the Super Bowl, you would expect that they maybe go to Vegas and they party on, or they go to Disneyland, as a lot of the players say. We are sitting here today recording this interview in Orange County, California, in St. Michael's Abbey. Why are you here in an abbey just after winning the Super Bowl?
Again, like I said earlier, I'm so excited for the offseason to be able to grow in my relationship with my wife and my children, but most importantly, with our Lord. I feel like the offseason is the time where I can break away from football that I've been playing for 7 months out of the year, and I can really grow closer to our Lord. Because we can all go party and make all great memories, but if that's not going to glorify God, if that's not going to get us closer to sainthood, then, you know, why are we doing it?
Sainthood is something that Harrison talks a lot about now. What he says is his desire to strive towards holiness in all aspects of his life.
I'm not just making kicks so that I can make money and I can, you know, puff myself up as this great person that people, you know, want to be like one day. I'm making kicks because God wants me to have a platform, at least for right now, to share this message of faith, of growing in virtue, of growing closer to the sacraments, and of being a saint. And I'm so passionate about that.
How do you stay grounded when you have all the trappings of success? Like you mentioned there, the incredible money that comes in the profession, the game you're in, with the cameras, with the attention, with all the glory. There's so many things that could distract you and tempt you.
Completely. I think number one, it starts with prayer. If you're able to sit down, if you're praying a rosary, if you're going to Mass, if you're doing mental prayer, and you're meditating on the lives of our Lord, on the life of, you know, a great saint, you start to realize how you are nothing, how you are ashes, you're dust, and everything that you have, all the talents that you have are given to you by God, and everything that you do that brings merit is just from God's grace. And so when you realize that, if someone tells you how great you are in your job, if someone wants an autograph, that's just because God gave me this talent for whatever reason, and people love it. I don't, you know, allow it to get to my head.
In the full exclusive interview, which you can now watch on EWTN's YouTube channel, Harrison and I spoke about some of his strong views, like his stance against abortion, something which he has been attacked for online.
Would you ever worry about the kind of cancel culture, the ramifications that you could face?
Of course. And that's when you have to be prudent and you have to decide what issues am I going to speak on, what issues am I not going to speak on. And for me, being pro-life and fighting against the atrocities that occur all around the world, especially in America, with murdering unborn children, that's something that I'm never going to compromise on. And if I get canceled for that, then so be it.
Harrison and his wife have moved into a new house in Kansas, where he continues to grow in his faith in a very deep way. In fact, he even built a small chapel inside his house. Do you ever have moments of doubt?
Yeah. I don't want to be a complete fraud up here. I don't want to say the wrong things. I want to make sure that I'm being used for good and not for...
But not just about your vocation or your role, but I mean about the faith. Do you ever...
Oh, doubt the faith?
Yeah.
Oh. Do you want me to be honest?
Or yeah, be honest, of course, yeah.
I do have doubts, but I have to remind myself of all the times in my life when I have trusted in God and how he's worked so beautifully in my life. So I'm seeing just the fruits of following his way.
Harrison, what's next?
I have no clue. That's a great question, but I'm going to take it one day at a time. I'm going to be the best man I possibly can be. I'm going to try to know, love, and serve God every moment of my life, and God will figure out the rest.
What's your slogan? Reach for the heights?
To the heights.
To the heights. Heights.
Yes.
To the heights.
Yes.
Harrison, I want to thank you, and I want to thank your beard as well. Thank you very much.
My beard thanks you. Thank you, Colm. I appreciate it.
In California, Colm Flynn, EWTN News in Depth.
A great way to kick off our Lenten season. And that's a wrap on this edition of EWTN News in Depth. I'm Montse Alvarado. We hope you'll be back same time next week for more reports important to your Catholic life. See you then.